Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is September 13th, 2005. This session, Expose Those Feet, From Moses to Ruth, Longing for Intimacy, a Bible study presented by Hans Dahl in the Fireside Room, disc number DAH-2005-01. Let's listen in.
Northwest of Seattle, beautiful place. I don't know how I got so lucky to have an internship out there. But if you haven't been to Whidbey Island, get out there. It's a beautiful, beautiful place. So now my wife and I are in, this is Katie, my wife here, and we are in transition. We finished internship, and we're on our way back to Minnesota, awaiting a call through the ELCA. And we are right now living out of Katie's father's and mother's garage. So we're in transition, to say the least.
Where is this?
They're in Steilacoom. South of Tacoma. So we pick up a truck when we're done here and head to Minnesota.
Oh.
So that's kind of where our life is at. We're in the midst of transition.
You're going immediately after this?
Yeah. So this is a great way to spend some time in the midst of transition, to be here and relax. But finishing up internship, I received two emails in the last 2 weeks, which made me go, What do people think of what I've been doing here? So the first story was this. A little lady came up to a pastor and she said, "I hope you didn't take it personally, Pastor." She said it after a church service, "when my husband walked out during your sermon." The pastor said, "I did find that rather disconcerting." "Well, it wasn't out of any disrespect for you," she said. Fred has been walking in his sleep ever since he was a I didn't know quite how to take that. I listened to my sermons for a whole year. And then I got another one. It was about a young preacher. He'd just gotten his first assignment, and the funeral home director called. He said they needed someone to perform a committal service. It was for a gentleman who really had no family left, you know, all alone, and so they just needed someone out there to say some words over the grave. So the young pastor got in his car, driving out in the country, trying to find this little graveyard.
Cemetery.
Yeah, and so he's driving all over, gets lost, finally ends up there about a half hour late. And so he gets to the cemetery, and all he sees is this group of workers off under this tree, and there's nobody else there. And he sees the hole, and so he walks over, pulls out his little, you know, pastors have their little book, and reads the service there, and notices that the cover has been placed on the coffin and everything. And so he's reading and finishes his little reading, and then walks towards his car, and he overhears the workers underneath the tree say, "Do you think we should have told him that's the septic tank?"
Probably use a blessing.
So as a new pastor, pray for me. What people are thinking.
Roll
with the punches. Let's begin our time with a word of prayer. The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
Dear God, we come to this place from all over, from different states, from different contexts, from different lives. We come to you as your broken people, people who have history, people who have stories of our own, stories of great joys and stories of pain. And we come to you as your people, and we ask that you open your word to us this day, that we might connect our story of brokenness with your story of brokenness. Amen.
Amen.
Let's open to Exodus. There's Bibles over here. If you don't have one, you can grab one. The theme for the summer is this take off your shoes business. And so I thought we'd start with the story, the theme story. And just, I'm really passionate about just reading the Bible. I think that's a good thing. I don't know. So I thought we'd just read the story this morning and talk about it. I'm a firm believer that Bible study happens in conversation. And so just to give you an idea, I did this Bible study on Luke this past year with our congregation. And we made it through about 6 chapters over the course of the whole year. So we moved kind of slow, but people asked a lot of questions. And so I hope you feel free to just ask questions. And one of the things, as you read Scripture, I want you to feel free to speak up when something catches you. Maybe there's something you go, what the heck is that all about? Because chances are, the rest of us are also thinking, what is that all about? So just speak your mind. If something comes up as we're going along, just holler, and we'll talk about it. Sound good? All right. So let's go to the beginning of Exodus. Exodus 1:8. So Exodus 1:8 begins, a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. There's a new king. And the question I think throughout our reading for today is, who is Lord in Egypt, in this place where there's a new king? Ramses II would have been this king. There's a transition here. And we'll find out more about that as we go. So we go on. He said to his people, look, the Israelite people are more numerous and more powerful than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, or they will increase, and in the event of the war, join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land. It's a story here of fear. The new Pharaoh here is fearful of what could happen. And verse 11, therefore, they set taskmasters over them to oppress them with forced labor. They built supply cities, Pithom and Ramses, for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites. The Egyptians became ruthless in imposing tasks on the Israelites and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and in every kind of field labor. They were ruthless in all the tasks they had imposed on them. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah and the other Puah. Those are, you know, if you're naming children, I don't know. Shiphrah and Puah? I don't know.
Call that out the back door a couple times.
Who are Jane?
When you act as midwives to the Hebrew women, so he's talking here to the Egyptian ladies, when you act as midwives to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it is a boy, kill him. But if it is a girl, she shall live. What do you think that's all about? They kill the boy.
They don't want no kings coming.
What's that?
They don't want any kings coming.
Yeah.
It's a male-dominated society.
Probably.
What's male-dominated society. Right, right. And so the family name continues through the male of the family. So it's a paternal system. So you kill off the male, you end the family.
And the women would be available for slaves or sex or whatever.
Yes. Very, very true. The women are always the vulnerable ones there. So, verse 17, the story goes on. But the midwives feared God. They did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them. Good, strong women like that. But they let the boys live. So the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and said to them, why have you done this and allowed the boys to live? The midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife comes to them. Doesn't that seem like, you know, yeah, exactly. Okay, let's make up. Oh, yeah, there's an excuse. Okay, so.
I got a flat tire.
Didn't get it.
Dog ate my homework. So God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and became very strong. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. Then the Pharaoh commanded all his people, every boy that is born to to the Hebrews, you shall throw into the Nile, but you shall let every girl live. So the Pharaoh is a little ticked off here, ticked off Pharaoh. So then we come to the story of Moses, and this summer at the church I worked at, we had a vacation Bible school that was, the theme was around the city of Jerusalem. We kind of turned the church into a little city, Jerusalem city. And we had a little marketplace, and because I was the pastor, they asked me to be the rabbi. Bert called me the rabbi when we walked in. So the little area I was in charge of was the synagogue school. And so as the day went on, I got different groups of kids that came through. So I asked them, what have you done today? Well, we've gone to the marketplace, we've gone out and done this and that. And I said, do you know where you are right now? Remember, it was called the synagogue school. And one little boy raised his hand and said, we've got to be at the cemetery school now. Like, well, close. But then another, we were asking, we were asking, there was another city, you know, we're talking about different cities that were, you know, in the land at that time. Now, Jerusalem was an important city, I said, but there was another community that was real close, and it was another important city in the Bible. It was a city where Jesus was born. It begins with a B, and for people who live out here, you'll get this, because the kid shot his hand up and said, B, it's got to be Bellingham.
Ballard.
Close. But then my favorite one was we were talking about, you know, Moses and the story of Moses leading the people out of Egypt. And I said, okay, so we talked about this yesterday. What's the name of the mountain where Moses went up to pray, received the Ten Commandments? And the little kid said, oh, I remember. It's Mount Satan. Close, Mount Sinai. So we've got the story of Moses, and Moses is entering our story here. Now, a man from the house of Levi went and married a Levite woman. The woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was a fine baby, she hid him 3 months. When she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and plastered it with clay and tar. She put the child in it and placed it among the reeds on the bank of the Nile, the river. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. The daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river. While her attendants walked beside the river, she saw the basket among the reeds and sent the maid to bring it. When she opened it, she saw a child. He was crying, and she took pity on him. This must be one of the Hebrew children, she said. Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and get you a nurse from the Hebrew women to nurse the child for you? The Pharaoh's daughter said to her, yes. So the girl went and called the child's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, take this child and nurse it for me, and I will give you your wages. So the woman took the child and nursed it. When the child grew up, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and she took him as her son. She named him Moses because, she said, I drew him out of the water. Now Moses, Larry, you probably know the Hebrew here better than I do. To draw out, is that Moses?
Not sure.
I think the name Moses is to draw out. And in some ways, you've got a little bit of a play in words here with the Hebrew, because she's then saying, I drew him out of water. And we know Moses is going to be the one to draw his people out of Egypt into the promised land. So we go on. One day, after Moses had grown up, he went out to his people and saw their forced labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his kinfolk. He looked this way and that, and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. When he went out the next day, he saw two Hebrews fighting, and he said to one, who was in the wrong, why do you strike your fellow Hebrew? He answered, who made you ruler and judge over us? Do you mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? Moses was afraid. He was scared and thought, surely the thing is known. When Pharaoh heard of it, he sought to kill Moses. But Moses fled from Pharaoh. He settled in the land of Midian and sat down by a well. The priest of Midian had 7 daughters and came to draw water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. But some shepherds came and drove them away. Moses got up and came to their defense and watered their flock. When they returned to their father Reuel, he said, how is it that you have come back so soon today? They said, an Egyptian helped us against the shepherds. He even drew water for us and watered the flock. He said to his daughters, where is he? Why did you leave the man? Invite him to break bread. Moses agreed to stay with the man, and he gave Moses his daughter Zipporah in marriage. She bore a son, and he named him Gershom. For he said, I have been an alien residing in a foreign land. There's this whole undercurrent here of Moses being in a foreign land. And the rest of the week, I'm going to really focus on Ruth. I thought we'd start with kind of the theme verses coming up here. But this idea of a foreigner living in a foreign land, I think that's a theme that we can all relate to from time to time, whether it's in the low times of life, feeling as though we're on the outside, looking in. After a long time, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites groaned under their slavery and cried out. Out of the slavery, they cry for help. Their cry for help rose up to God. God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God looked upon the Israelites, and God took notice of them. So Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian. He led his flock beyond the wilderness and came to Horeb, or Mount Sinai, the mountain of God. There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of a bush. He looked, and the bush was blazing, yet it was not consumed. Then Moses said, I must turn aside and look at this great sight and see why the bush is not burned up. It's not burned up. When the Lord saw that he had turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, Moses, Moses. And he said, here I am. Then he said, come no closer. Remove the sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. That's the theme verse for this summer has been, you're standing on holy ground. Take off those shoes. What do you think's going on? What's that all about? What do you think that business is about? Remove the sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. Any ideas what that's about?
Something about showing respect.
Showing respect. Yeah. In the Muslim tradition, when you enter a mosque, it's customary you take off your shoes at the door as a sign of respect. Yeah.
For the men, the women got to stay outside.
Yeah.
Let's not get into that.
Show respect and be silent.
I'm not touching it because I know I'm not numbers.
You're a smart man.
In the Ethiopian church, also, you take off your shoes before.
Yeah, take off your shoes.
Yes. Yeah. I can't go in there either. I tried.
You're trying to do that. Yeah. You take off your shoes. My dad was a missionary in Japan for a short while.
So
they would take off their shoes. They'd go into someone's house, or you'd sit down and eat. You always took your shoes off. Your sandals. Yeah.
I wonder if it goes back to that notion of cleanliness. I mean, you're walking around dirty streets. Mm-hmm. And in the presence of the holy, you've got this sense of ritual purity that needs to be maintained. So I wonder if that's partly it.
Yeah, I think there's something there. It's your feet are covered to keep the dirt away, you know, to keep, and so your feet are supposedly cleaner than your shoes are.
Yeah, but when they trekked around the desert in their sandals, their feet weren't clean.
Yeah, this is true.
It just takes shake the dust off the shoes, off their feet. Go the other way, but that probably was at least a significant, I don't know.
A symbolic,
yeah.
Yeah, something symbolic there.
I think another aspect, the phrase is literally ground of holiness. As Adama Kadosh. And Adama, which means ground or clay or fertile earth, is related to the word Adam, which is human being. So if you take off your shoes, you're back in touch with that from which you've been created.
Yeah. There's a connection. You're grounded again. You're connected again to this creation. And, I can't remember what movie it was with Julia Roberts. And at the end, somewhere in the movie, is it Julia Roberts and Richard Gere where they're in the park and she takes off her shoes and they have this little picnic in the park. And whenever I hear this, I think... Is that it? I don't know.
Pretty Woman.
Is that what it is?
That's it, Pretty Woman. That's right, the first one.
You know, I think of taking off your shoes and that feel of grass, you know, under your feet or dirt, or you're on the beach feeling the sand. There's a connection. You know, it's reconnecting yourself with where you've come from. There is a sense in the Old Testament also that when feet are uncovered, there's this sense of intimacy there. And that's something I want us to remember as we go through this whole week together, or as long as you're here. So when feet are uncovered, there's intimacy there. There's this sense that when we uncover the theme, I don't remember what I wrote down, expose your feet. Yeah. when that part of you is uncovered, it's exposing something which is of intimacy. And so the intimacy of yourself is connected intimately with the ground. You know, you're going back to the land. And so you're connecting. So remove your sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. There's also a sense here that's the first thing that God is saying to Moses. The first thing he says, it's almost like, okay, Moses, relax. You know, relax. Take off your shoes. Just stop for a moment and be in the presence of God. I think for a lot of us, that's why we come out here to this place. You know, just to stop for a minute and to be on holy ground, you know, just to be for a while in the presence of God. So we continue on here with verse 6. We'll just go a little bit further. He said further, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. Then the Lord said, I have observed the misery of your people who are in Egypt. I have heard your cry on account of the taskmasters. Indeed, I know their suffering, and I have come down to deliver them from the Egyptians. I've heard the story of your broken life. I've heard the story of your pains. I've heard the valleys that you've traveled through. And I've come down to deliver them from the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the country of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites and the Jebusites. The cry of the Israelites has now come to me. I have also seen how the Egyptians oppress them. So come, I will send you to Pharaoh to bring my people and the Israelites out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, and these are my favorite words here, who the heck am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? Who am I to do this? What are you talking about here? He said, I will be with you. And I think the promise we hear throughout the Old Testament is this God who will be there, will be present throughout. And this shall be the sign for you, that it is I who sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall worship God on this mountain, Mount Sinai. So this is kind of where the theme for the summer comes from. And I just thought it'd be kind of a nice precursor to where we go in Ruth this week, talking about this wonderful story of these wonderful women. I love good stories about strong women in the Bible. I don't think we use these stories enough. But this gives us kind of that precursor, this promise that that God makes to you, that this is a promise that I will be with you through the floods, through the fires, through the terror. We read in Romans, neither life nor death nor anything can separate us from that love of God. So, having said that, let's turn to Ruth. Judges, just kind of page through. It's this little tiny book. It's hard to find.
Where are you,
Ruth? Where are you, Ruth? Ruth! Where are you? It's the best thing about the Bible. There's a table of contents in the beginning. So you just look there and find it. Now, I'm not any kind of biblical scholar whatsoever, but just use this. When I got the call, by the way, I'm not Susan Briel. Susan Briel was supposed to be here this week to put up with me. She called and said, Hans, I need someone to fill in. I said, what am I supposed to do? Teach? She said, what have you been doing? I said, well, I just got done with Ruth. That's perfect. I'm filling in for Susan Briel for the week up at Holden. I said, well, you have to learn to articulate more, because Susan is the most articulate person I think I know. And you might want to buy a pair of pumps to wear. So Ruth comes to us, this book in the Bible here. If you turn back a page to the last sentence, or last verse of Judges, it gives us a little context, I think, for what Ruth is, I think Ruth is trying to contrast, the writer of Ruth is contrasting. Judges is this written in a time where it's kind of chaotic time for God's people. It's a time of chaos, and the last verse I think kind of sums it up, verse 25 in the last chapter of Judges. In those days there was no king in Israel. All the people did what was right in their own eyes. And the result was violence. It was a violent time. It was a time when the judges were there, but the people really kind of ruled on their own. It was just a chaotic time. We read stories of rape and of murder and of abduction. And people literally did what they thought was right, you know? Or what they wanted to do, right. What felt good, you know? Some say that we're raising a generation of feel-good types. This is what happens. They did what felt right, and the result was violence. And so we turn to Ruth, and we get quite the contrast. We get a beautiful contrast, and I think Ruth is one of the most beautiful literary books in the Bible. And I hope that we read it as literature this week. Sometimes when we read books of the Bible, we go, well, did that really happen? Did that not happen? And I hope for this week we just get rid of that question and read this as a story, as a novel of God's faithfulness. We had finished moving our stuff the other day, and we were sitting around the dinner table with Katie's mom and dad. And we're just about done eating, having light, you know, dinner conversation. Katie's mom turned to me and said, so what are you teaching on at Holden this week? And I said, well, I think we're going to dig into Ruth. I've done that, you know, this summer. And she said, well, how would you sum Ruth up? I'm like, isn't dessert coming here? And she talked about how this beautiful song that we're going to read today was read at her mother's funeral, and how this story to her was the story of is a story of faithfulness. It's not only it's a story of Ruth's faithfulness and loyalty, but we see throughout this book the hand of God, God's faithfulness to God's people, God's faithfulness in fulfilling the promises to us that God has made, and that God holds true to those promises, working through people. And so let's dig in here to Ruth, and we're going to move slow. I hope that's okay. But I want you to ask questions and us to think about this. Where are we going here? So continuing from the time of the judges here, we have this contrast. And so beginning at verse 1, in the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. Famine is it cut off life, you know, took food away. And so in those days, you didn't run down to the market, you know. This was a horrible time. And a certain man of Bethlehem in Judah went to live in the country of Moab. So going across the sea over to the other side, went to live in Moab. He and his wife and two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech. Now, one of the beautiful things in this that the Hebrews would have read, they would have heard in these names are some deep meaning. And it's one of the beautiful things that we miss in the English. So Elimelech would have meant, my God is king. So this was what this name means. My God is king. So they read this and they go, oh, my God is king. This is the name of the family name, Elimelech. And the name of his wife was Naomi. Naomi means sweetness or pleasantness. So you start out, my God and king, and then you move to the name Naomi, sweetness or pleasantness. And the names of the two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. So Mahlon and Chilion, or Kilion, is sickness and spent. So right away in this story, you have foreshadowing or what's going to happen. You've got sickness and spent. So they were Ephrathites from Bethlehem in Judah. They went into the country of Moab and remained there. But Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died. And she was left with her two sons. These took Moabite wives. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other was Ruth. So Orpah, they would have read that and heard the back, or in a sense, it's the back of the neck is the name, is what her name. There would have been this. They would have read it and heard, well, what's that about? The back of the neck? What? There's something being foreshadowed here. There's something to come. And so the writer weaves this within all these names. And then Ruth meaning friend or companion. So you've got Elimelech, meaning my God is king. Then you've got Naomi, sweetness or pleasantness. And then you've got Mahlon and Chilion, and you've got this foreshadowing of being of spent and sickness. And then you've got Orpah in the back of the neck, and Ruth, companion, sweetness. Or not sweetness, but friend. So, continuing on, when they had lived there for about 10 years, so the sons are dead, father's dead, and now it's this woman from Bethlehem living in a foreign land with two foreign daughters. Both Mahlon and Chilion also died. We find that out here. So that the woman was left without her two sons and her husband. So this is kind of a grim situation here. Kind of a depressing story to start out here this morning. What are the issues at hand here? I think there are a couple of different issues here that kind of set up the story. For right from the beginning, there's the issue of food. How are they going to eat? And so they went to Moab to find food. But now there's this story, similar to the story in we read about in Egypt, where the sons are killed, is how is the family going to be continued? How is this family name? This would have been a big deal.
It is. It is because the male children were supposed to be the ones that took care of their mother.
Yeah.
And she had no livelihood because her whole family had died.
Yeah. And they're living in a foreign land, you know, a land of all kinds of different gods and all kinds of different people. So they're living in a foreign land, and now this Jewish woman has two foreign daughters as well. And so it's kind of a desperate situation here. So what's going to happen? I think there's several questions we can ask there. But I think the main issues here are food and family name. How is this family going to be continued? So let's continue on. Then she started to return with her daughters-in-law from the country of Moab. For she had heard in the country of Moab that the Lord had considered his people and given them food. So it's interesting. Right away, we have the Lord stepping in. We have God stepping in and doing something about the food. Okay, God's going to take care of them, and God's bringing them back to the land of their home, back to Bethlehem. Okay, so she set out from the place where she had been living, she and her two daughters-in-law, and they went on their way back to the land of Judah. But Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go back, each of you, to your mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find security, each of you, in the house of your husband." So, what's going on here? Why would she? I would think for a woman being alone, having some companions along the journey would be kind of a good thing. But instead she's saying, get out of here. Go back. Go back.
Go back and get married again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Go back where maybe there's more prospects for yourself. The land of Moab.
Go ahead. I thought it was interesting that the daughters-in-law stick with their mother-in-law. Most so often we hear stories of people can't get along with their in-laws.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And here it's, they're closely knit.
Yeah, yeah. There is this
and
connection.
The obvious love that Naomi has for her daughters enough mm-hmm. to want to have them go back where they can have a life instead of what would be easiest for her.
Mm-hmm. There is some faithfulness of her being able to say, okay, go back. I wonder if in Naomi's eyes, if she's going, what will it be like to bring back to Bethlehem
two Moabite women?
I mean, that would have been, I think, a difficult transition as well. I mean, I don't want to put too much of a selfishness on her at all, on Naomi, but I would think there would have been some of those thoughts in her mind. What's it like to bring people back into this community? Bring outsiders into this community. Well, let's keep going. So the end of, verse 9. I should ask, how late did we go? We go till 10, okay. The Lord, verse 9, the Lord, so this is Naomi speaking, the Lord grant that you may find security, each of you in the house of your husband. Then she kissed them, and they wept aloud. They said to her, "No, we will return with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Do I still have sons in my womb that they may become your husbands? Turn back, my daughters. Go your way, for I am too old to have a husband. Even if I thought there was hope for me, even if I should have a husband tonight and bear sons, would you then wait until they were grown?" I can't have kids anymore. Too late. What do you think? You know? What do you think? Oh, man. And it's interesting. If we go back to verse 5, where does it say? Verse 4. the second half of that verse. So it said, they took Moabite wives, and the name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other is Ruth, when they had lived there about 10 years. There's nothing spoken here about the two daughters, daughter-in-laws, having children. And many of the commentaries say there's a cue there. Something's going on there. You know, it would have been customary to have children right very soon after. And so there's a cue here that these daughters also don't have children. They don't have children, they're all alone, and something strange about having been together. Might they, too, like others in our stories in the Bible, had issues with childbearing? You know, was there some barrenness, their inability to have children? And so I think that's another kind of something we need to follow as we go through this, because that would have been also a way to carry on the family if there would have been a son. But there wasn't that. So they're looking for husbands. You know, there's a need for husbands to carry on the family name.
But they're also looking for husbands in their home base. And what just hit me is when we're in disarray, we go back to our roots, we go back to home. And like, go home to your heart kind of thing when you're upset with, you know, God's always calling us home when there's a problem. And yesterday, last night, when there was a poem, prayer, or the Muhammad.
Yeah.
Something about, you know, you have to cut off the string when you get all tangled up from the needle and go back to the beginning again.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a comfort in going home.
Right.
Going, you know, I often think about that as when we think about the life of faith sometimes, you know. There are periods in people's lives where you grow up in faith. And if you're like most of us, you know, your early 20s, you know, your late teens, you kind of drift away. And somehow when you have kids and life is chaotic again, you find your way back in the church, you know. You find your way back home. Yeah. So, the issue of husbands. Yeah, go back to Moab. There's plenty of men there. You can find yourself a husband back there. It'll be easier. You're putting yourself out if you come with me. So verse 13. Would you then wait until they were grown? So talking about, you know, it's kind of humorous, you know, what she's saying here. You know, this grown woman, she's most likely past menopause, and she can't have kids. This isn't gonna happen. Like, come on. Would you then refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, it has been far more bitter for me than for you, because the hand of the Lord has turned against me.
That I didn't understand. Why is she putting the blame on God?
Yeah. What do people think about that? You think that's natural? Is that a response?
Grief has all different faces.
Yeah. Yeah.
When I'm trying to find out why.
Yeah.
If you're rooted in God, then you ask God why a lot of times.
Yeah. Well, part of my journey in my life is that when I was a child, when I was in fifth grade, my mother passed away. Oh man, do I remember those feelings of, you know, God, why? You know? I mean, we've all had, you know, experiences of loved ones that are left our lives for one reason or another, and why, you know, or that, you know, you look at the devastation down in Louisiana and Mississippi, and you can't help but, you know, have some bit of that why, you know, and I think that was a natural response. I think that's part of the, like you said, the grief process. There is this why, God.
To a certain extent, accept the death of folk who are older. And if Naomi is older, she has grief, but she can accept the death of her husband. But the death of her sons is something else. And it's kind of that phrase, if somebody dies who's older, it's the death of the past. But if somebody dies who's younger, that's the death of the future.
Pastor I've worked with, had a wonderful way of saying, there was a son who passed away this last year and said, we are just not wired to bury our children. Mm-hmm. I thought that just really summed it up for me. You know, we're just not wired to do that. Yeah. So, digging back in here, verse 14, then the daughters, then they wept aloud. And now we find out why Orpah is named what she is. Does anyone remember what her name is?
Back of the neck.
Back of the neck. So then then they wept aloud, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law. But Ruth clung to her. So let's keep going. So she said, see, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law. So the sense of the back of the neck, the sense of Orpah turning and going. I think often people dig into Orpah here a little bit and they say, well, what in the world? What are you thinking? You know, what kind of a daughter-in-law is that, turning her back on? But I think it would have been more of a natural response. It's like going back to my family, you know, in time of crisis, you go home to what you know, what you grew up with. So you've got Orpah turning away and going back to what she knows.
And Naomi really frees her to do that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's almost like Naomi is begging here. Just go. Go back to what you know. Go back to what's comfortable. Go back to where you're going to find, in some ways, an abundant life with your people, with your gods, with your life that you know.
Go or at back. Least a secure life.
Oh, yeah.
Because her parents would take them back in, mostly.
Yeah, she might not be able to be married if she is barren.
Yeah.
All that, but she wouldn't be subject to the insecurity that Naomi and Ruth will soon come to face.
Yeah.
Doesn't the name, when I think of the name, the back of the neck, I think of vulnerability.
Mm.
You know, like how animals carry their gun type. Mm. And so that's what I'm looking for is.
Hmm.
If they have this meaning in there.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. There definitely is vulnerability in their situation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's important to think about. You know, think of the situation that Naomi is in right now. I mean, with the male-dominated society, she is left without anything. I mean, what carries, you know, whatever land they have or whatever they have of value is carried only by her husband's name. And so she really is in a desperate, desperate situation. And so, in a way, I mean, we don't, there are a lot of things in the story we don't know. You know, what did Ruth and Orpah have to go back to? We don't know what's there. But what we do know is the desperate situation that Naomi is bringing down into.
But could she be in depression and with the feeling, just leave me alone, I want my space?
Oh, yeah.
Kids, get out of here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it could be. It could be.
She maybe didn't want the responsibility mm-hmm. of the two other women.
Yeah, we don't necessarily know what the societal situation would have been. I mean, is it that the daughters-in-law would have been responsible for taking care of their mother-in-law, or would the mother-in-law have been responsible for taking care? I mean, we don't exactly know, but there would have been, moving back into the Bethlehem society, there would have been more pressure on, I would think, on Naomi to try and bring them into, how do you bring these foreign ladies into the fold?
Leave their own gods.
Yeah.
There could have been a lot of combination, and if they were barren, they could have come into like a prostitution type of situation, like being used by the men because they had no other use there,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
in the sense that my first instinct is Naomi trying to protect them?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Protect them from what could happen.
Because there is such a focus on being in foreign lands.
We're assuming that they're barren, not that the men were sterile.
That's exactly
Yes, exactly.
But they probably wouldn't have been too accepted, you know. Men wouldn't want them as wives anyway.
Yeah.
So what else could they be used for?
The onus would have been put on the women, regardless of what the real situation was.
They had to take responsibility for that.
And Rahab wasn't barren.
No.
No, because she had a child there. But the conception in the Bible was that it was always the woman's barrenness, because the idea of childbirth was that you had this, the egg was a fully formed little person. I'm not sure what the semen did.
Along for the ride.
Got the men in trouble? I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, wasn't it the semen that held the whole thing? That was it. The semen had the whole little baby. That's why, there's another biblical story. It was said masturbation was such an awful thing.
Oh, yes.
Baby. So, yeah, the semen held the little egg and the mom was an incubator.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, the man was the one that provided the key component, we'll say.
Bible sex ed. Sorry.
Wow. Get a little hot in here. Anybody need a water break? All right, so that, now we go into this beautiful, beautiful song. I mean, we hear this, these words at weddings and things like this, this, these beautiful words of loyalty. Can we have a, is there a woman who'd be willing to read this section? Who would be willing to read this? Jean, would you read this?
Oh, I'd love to read this. Do not press me to leave you, or to turn back from following you. Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. There will I be buried. May the Lord do thus, and so to me, and more as well, if even death parts me from you.
Anything throughout that catch you? Anything grab you? Anything touch you in a different way?
Well, the two of them must have had a good relationship. A good mother-in-law, daughter-in-law relationship, which sometimes you don't hear about.
Yeah. You always hear of the in-laws coming to visit. Yeah.
She was a witness. Naomi was a witness for God.
That's what I was thinking. Ruth must have admired her and her life and how she carried herself. She wanted to be like her. That was why she would also follow her God.
Yeah. There was one commentary I read that said, we don't know what Ruth would have gone back to, but we know that what she had now was better. You know, and that was kind of pushing the boundary a little bit, kind of reading into the text, but I thought that was kind of interesting. This Naomi's, you know, it's interesting. Where you go, I will go. So your land will be my land. Your people will be my people. Where you die, even till death, I will also be buried there. And may the Lord do thus. My God, and your God will be my God. I mean, this is a radical transformation. I mean, this is a
total commitment.
This is a radical commitment, a new life.
I was struck by the "your people shall be my people," because if we're talking about someone being in a foreign land, and we talked earlier about the comfort of returning to what's familiar, you know, if Ruth is saying "your people shall be my people," she's taking the risks of what it means to embrace another culture, another way of life, another home, and that I think would be pretty radical at that time.
But she had 10 years of experience with in the household, and there's so many things in the religious and cultural customs from Israel were practiced in that home, even though they were in her home. So she knew what she was getting into, but.
I wonder if moving to Bethlehem, there would have been a sense of the Moabite people being oppressed in that culture. You know, they would have been the slaves. They would have been the ones that are the outcasts, the outsiders. And so, Yeah, this is kind of a radical a radical decision, a radical commitment here. I just finished reading it's a story on the life of Desmond Tutu and a lot of his theology, and the sense that he had that we are all interconnected, you know, that we are interdependent people and we need one another. And that's the way that they overcame, you know, very simply overcame apartheid. That's totally simplifying it. But the concept was not that, you know, it wasn't, okay, so there was this power that the white people had, and then there was this, you know, there were some that were saying, no, this is a black country and this is black power. But what Desmond Tutu said is, no, we all need each other. You know, there's this interdependence. And I think about that in the sense of this story, of her walking in as one who it would have been oppressed in that culture, walking in saying, okay, your God is my God. I know this isn't a great situation I'm going into, but there's something about you, Naomi, and I'm going to be loyal to you, and I promise to be faithful to you and to your God.
With the fact that she married an Israelite, change her status as a foreigner or look down on, not that we know anything about that in culture?
That's a good question.
I mean, if she had 10 years in this new culture, in the home household, did she look radically different? Was her skin darker or lighter or something? Was there something to distinguish her? Mm-hmm. Or could she just fold in?
Go ahead, Larry.
I'm hesitant to break out of the context of the story because we're really in the story itself. But there's a good possibility that the Book of Ruth is written either during the time or shortly after the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, when the emphasis was so strongly on reconstituting the separateness of the house of Israel over and against everyone else. And the demand of Ezra and Nehemiah that the Israelites who'd been in Babylon for 40 years, or those who were left in the land who had married foreign wives, they had to kick the foreign wives out.
Thank you.
And then in that context, I think the Book of Ruth developed.
They were foreigners. And that was the bell. Time flies, huh?
Coffee break
time. Good. Well, thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
How about we meet same place, same time tomorrow?